This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
31 days and a couple hours till Election Day. The economy is pretty much set. We got the last big indicator today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. At Michigan Radio today in beautiful downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Friday today, the 7th of October. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. The first Friday of the month it is, which means today is Jobs Day. That is where we're going to start the next 5 minutes of live radio and then move briskly onward to the rest of the global economy. Catherine Rampell is from The Washington Post. Cardiff Garcia is from the blog FT Alphaville. They are both in our studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, let me start with you. Jobs, the rate ticked up a little bit, 5.0, 156,000 new jobs, net-net. Good report. What else you got?
Yeah, I would say a pretty good report. The jobless rate, as you noted, went up, but it kind of went up for the right reason, as economists like to say, meaning that more people joined the labor force. And actually, we've now had a few months recently where unemployed workers were more likely to transition into getting a job rather than dropping out of the labor force. So there are a lot of indications that things are moving in the right direction.
The phrase we're talking about here, Cardiff, is labor force participation rate ticking up just a hair. A good thing. People getting back in.
A wonderful thing. I think this was an underrated jobs report. I loved this jobs report, you know. I did.
The headline numbers. Word, pal.
Yeah, I know, but the headline numbers seem kind of meh. Like, yeah, big deal. It's been doing about what it's been doing for a few months now. But so many people rejoining the labor force. And if you look at the longer trend over the past year or so, you've seen that actually that number for people in their prime working years, 25 to 54, has ticked up quite a bit. And remember, it wasn't that long ago that we were all saying, when are all these people going to rejoin the labor force?
Right.
What if they never do? What if they're just gone and the economy has a permanent loss for it? Well, it looks like that hasn't happened. It looks like things are getting better. And yet there was nothing in the report that would tempt Janet Yellen to hike rates sooner than everybody expects, which is December. So I like this report.
Well, I would say that the wage gains were pretty good. So we've now had like 3.5 years of wage gains, meaning that like in inflation adjusted terms, meaning that people's wages are going up faster than inflation,
incomes,
which is still quite low,
real
incomes. So it's you're probably right. It's not going to change the path of Fed policy right now. But if we're looking looking for signs of greater inflation, you know, if you're really, really an inflation hawk, then maybe you would say that. That's a little sign that something's coming on the horizon.
That's worth noting that that's a wonderful trend, higher wage growth. I mean, that's great news
that.
For people.
Right. Very quickly, Cardiff, this is the last big indicator before the election. I mean, you know, the next jobs report comes out like 2 days before it or something. So this is the economy we're going to have.
This is the one. It's set in stone. And by the way, It's been pretty good. It's been resilient through an awful lot of global turmoil in the last few years. What you've seen is a powerfully countercyclical American economy that hasn't been great, but that it's weathered a lot of the storm better than other economies in the developed world.
Talk to me then, Catherine, about that larger developed world. I want to talk really quickly about the British pound, which had sort of a flash crash overnight. It went down to $1.18 to the pound, which is well below where it was even after the Brexit vote. Blame has been cast on a fat finger trade. Somebody just goofed. But people are talking now about
an algorithm.
Or an algorithm, right.
Whatever. We don't know yet.
More likely, right. Right, more likely. But people are talking about, you know, the dollar, the pound getting down to $1.05, the record here now against the dollar. Put all of that in the context of Theresa May this week talking about a date certain for Brexit and where things stand globally.
So, yes, this flash crash last night, say that 10 times fast, was a one-off, you know, is a screw-up of some kind. But there are a lot of people who do worry that the pound will continue to fall further depending on what the terms of the Brexit are. And there are indications that they could be pretty tough, which could be damaging for the UK economy, you know, in terms of flow of people, flow of money, flow of trade. So there are a lot of reasons of everything. Exactly. That's the whole point of the Brexit is that it is less integrated, that the UK would be less integrated with the rest of the EU. And depending on the economic ramifications of all of that, that could have major implications for the currency.
All right. So, Cardiff, throw all of that, the global context there, in with the troubles of Deutsche Bank, which is under the thumb of the Department of Justice. They're talking about a huge, huge mortgage loan involvement settlement there and what that means for European banks and then the rest of us.
Sure. So for European banks, I think the outlook is still a little bit cloudy. Right now, it looks like Deutsche Bank will just about be able to weather whatever it is that the Department of Justice throws at it. But these things can escalate quickly, so it's hard to say. It's worth noting, though, that in terms of the American banks' exposure to European banks, things are a little bit better than they were in the past because the American banks actually fixed themselves in a way that the European banks didn't. So I actually think there's a chance that although it's not going to be pleasant, whatever ends up happening to European banks isn't something that's going to have really big contagious effects for the U.S.
But I would also suggest that, that the last thing you want to have is a bank that just about makes it, right? That's not a net positive thing.
No, no, it's not. None of this is positive.
Well, especially since Deutsche Bank is still being investigated for potential money laundering.
Right.
So it's like they're not out of the woods yet.
Yeah, it has other problems too, for sure.
We, however, are out of the woods. We got to go. Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post, Cardiff Garcia at the blog FT Alphaville. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, see you. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, a little of this, a little of that. One eye on the jobs numbers, the other on the Fed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hurricane Matthew has been moving up the coast of Florida all day. Thankfully, it is off the coast, not right on it. That's about a 100-mile difference that could translate into billions of dollars less in damage. Georgia and the Carolinas are on the alert for high winds and flooding, the two big threats, of course, from a storm like this. Storms that almost always do serious damage to the power grid. The Florida Public Service Commission says more than 1 million customers are in the dark today. Another 1 million or more are in the way of the storm as it moves north, with a power grid that is still surprisingly vulnerable to nature. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
It's not that Florida hasn't prepared. It spent $2 billion to toughen its grid, to buy, say, concrete power poles instead of wood. But no system is completely stormproof. One issue is that the grid has so many poles and wires to start out with. A century ago, power systems were built locally, says Larry Riley at Rosewood Energy Consulting.
The generators were very close to the customers, but over time, with advances in transmission technology and economies of scale, the grid tended to centralize and generators tended to be moved away from the population centers.
In a storm, long-distance wires are vulnerable to falling trees or flying debris. Another issue is ground-level substations that in Florida are really close to sea level. Some will flood. Mike Jacobs at the Union of Concerned Scientists says that's how the system was built.
You put the equipment where people have decided to live. The settlements came before the electricity. And coastal areas, certainly of Florida, don't have a lot of high ground to choose from.
The grid problem is getting worse. In the last three decades, major outages in the U.S. have multiplied 20-fold, says engineering professor Masoud Amin at the University of Minnesota.
There are two factors. Unprecedented weather hitting them. And secondly is aging infrastructure, because the average age in the overall system is somewhere between 40 to 60 years old.
An analyst once told me that today's grid is like inheriting your great-grandfather's car. So, a disaster like this could be an opportunity, Amin says, not just to rebuild, but to build back better and more resilient. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Presidential debate number two comes on Sunday night, Washington University in St. Louis, a town hall format this time, questions from the audience. So it's anybody's guess what the questions are going to be. But it's a safe bet that in one or more of the answers, you'll hear Donald Trump saying something about his business prowess and how that would be an advantage for him in running the government. Trump is not the first candidate to run on his business record, probably won't be the last, but the results have been thoroughly mixed through history. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
Not everyone thinks Donald Trump is the quintessential businessman. Be that as it may, he is running on his business record. There's a plus side to doing that and a minus side. Let's get the plus side from Princeton presidential historian Julian Zelizer.
There is a sense for many Americans that politicians and government is inefficient. There is a belief, whether it's right or wrong, that in the private sector, you can't do that. So someone successful must be able to move forward on difficult issues.
Zelizer says Herbert Hoover ran for president on his business record. George W. Bush talked about bringing his private sector decision-making to government.
Small oil person.
Even Jimmy Carter talked up his business bona fides.
To put our people back to work.
And again, Zelizer says Carter used that to connect to small business owners.
And he used his business record to root himself in small business America, in rural America.
But Carter, Bush, and even Hoover also had political records to run on. Zelizer says Donald Trump is unusual in that he's only running on his business experience. Even Mitt Romney was a governor. And that brings us to the minus side of running for president as a business person. It can be really hard to explain business decisions to voters. So says J.W. Verrett, a former advisor to Romney, now a senior scholar with the Mercatus Center.
This is, I think, what goes to the heart of the difficulty of being a business person running for office is that in the short term, there's often just an ugly side to business.
And that can turn voters off. For example, Romney's firm, Bain Capital, was criticized for closing companies and laying off workers. In this campaign, Donald Trump has similar problems. Running on a business record is hard. At a bar in downtown Washington, people watched the first debate like it was a football game. Listen to how they react when Hillary Clinton accuses Trump of benefiting from the recession and housing collapse.
Well, it did collapse.
That's called business, buddy.
9 million people. 9 million people lost their jobs.
If you didn't catch that, Trump said, quote, "That's called business, by the way."
It's a hustle, really.
That's how it sounds to Brandon Brokaw. He watched the debate out on the bar's quieter patio. He's a waiter in Washington, far from Trump's universe.
In his world, they kind of normalize these hustles. You know, people with a lot of money tend to use their wealth as a way to get other people to buy into the BS, so to speak.
Brokaw is voting for Clinton. But back in the noisy bar, even a Trump supporter, Mark Egan, told me he wishes Trump would stop talking about how rich he is.
Yeah, him talking about his personal stuff is just totally not the right move. He needs to stop doing that.
Egan wants Trump to tell us how his success would make everyone successful if he's elected. That's right in line with what Craig Garthwaite told me. He teaches at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management.
We often say we want like a good business person to come run government. The job of government is not to maximize profits, and therefore things that make you a good business person might not make you a good elected official.
And that's a problem if you don't have a political record to run on. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
macroeconomics, which was behaving like a science, has become a pseudoscience.
Macroeconomics is a bunch of hooey. You heard it here first, folks. First, though, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 28 points today, about a 10%, 18,240 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 14 points, 0.2%, 5,292. The S&P 500 slumped 7 points lower, a third of 1%, 2,153. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow and the NASDAQ both off 0.4%, the S&P 500 down 0.7%. Walmart is doing a bit of an inventory check. It told investors today they plan to focus on e-commerce sales. Walmart down 0.9%. Costco packaged up 0.3% today. Property and casualty insurers are watching Hurricane Matthew carefully. Heritage Insurance Holdings secured 5.9% today. Allstate rose 0.9%. Travelers up 1.1%. Bonds, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As I said a couple of minutes ago, the next debate is Sunday night in St. Louis. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been in that city for the past couple of days talking to people to get a sense of what they want to hear from the candidates. Here you go.
At Tower Grove Christian Academy, a private school in St. Louis, teacher and volleyball coach Donna Kohlberg is disgusted with the election. She says she will watch the debate on Sunday. Kohlberg wants more information on Trump University, Clinton's actions in Benghazi.
And I would also like to hear a little bit more about their plans of how they're going to change the economy.
Let's be clear, Missouri is a pretty conservative state. Kohlberg's top issue is abortion, and she's reluctantly leaning towards Trump right now. But there is another big issue she says is on the minds of everyone here.
Jobs. How are you going to get us jobs?
She says, enough talk, though. Time for specifics.
But are these service jobs? Are these industrial jobs? What are we going to do to draw businesses here that's going to want them to invest here?
Terrence Jones, a political science professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, says the region has lost a lot of manufacturing jobs over the years.
We are more of an industrial Midwestern state, and so the issues about jobs and how people with lower levels of education are faring in our economy, income inequality, are very relevant in St. Louis.
And that ties into another topic likely to come up in the debate, Ferguson, and the continuing racial issues that still put people on edge.
The racial divide shows up on all indicators, both economic and non-economic, health infant mortality, as well as poverty and unemployment rates.
Andrew Wilson is picking up his elementary school age daughter from Tower Grove. He's a cop in St. Louis and ready for the debate.
So, I mean, I'll be working 4 12-hour shifts. Back to back to back to back.
He definitely wants to hear the candidates talk about race. Wilson is black and still an undecided voter. He wants to know how the candidates plan to heal community relations. Like many of the parents at this private Christian school, he says he'll make his decision with prayer.
You know, even beyond just being a police officer, I'm a Christian, and I believe that what this country needs is God back in government and schools and everything else. So, I mean, coming up this weekend, that'll be one of my things that I focus on.
Across the parking lot, pilot Micah Maupin, picking up a couple of his 12 kids, says he won't vote for Clinton, but isn't sold on Trump either. Big issues for him, what he sees as overregulation of small businesses and taxes.
You know, and every time I look at it, it's like, you know, my take-home pay decreases because the taxes increase or something else increases. You know, and I don't have more. I got 12 kids to take care of.
He's looking into third-party candidates, but says he's worried about throwing away his vote. Maupin says neither of the main candidates will do much for his family. In St. Louis, Missouri, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The National Football League finds itself in a somewhat unusual position this year. After years, decades, really, of television success, ratings so far this season are down 10% overall. Monday nights are doing the worst, off 17%. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has a look at what's going on.
First of all, we don't actually know if fewer people are watching games overall.
We don't only consume football on television.
Travis Vogan is a communications professor at the University of Iowa. Friendly reminder, he says people are moving really quickly from TV to watching on phones, tablets, computers, and the rating system hasn't caught up. Michael Lisko, a professor of sports management at Southern Methodist University, also says some of the matchups just haven't been strong so far. And each year, there are a few more games to choose from.
Monday night, Sunday night, Thursday night, all day Sunday. You know, I'd be divorced if I watched football, you know, when it was always on.
Still, there have been some unusual things going on this season. For one, protests by players upset about racism and police violence. And with that, counter-protests. Aaron Batwinski, a lifelong Packers fan, says he's boycotting the NFL.
I love football. I love the game. But the NFL has absolutely ruined it. They've made it way too political.
A Rasmussen poll this week found almost a third of adults in the U.S. said they were less likely to watch NFL games because of the players' protests. The final factor is that the NFL is competing with another face-off, Clinton and Trump. Their first debate, the most watched presidential debate ever, was during Monday Night Football. The Packers are playing the Giants during the next debate Sunday. Travis Vogan again.
So that'll be kind of an interesting test to see where America's interests lie.
Personally, I'm going with the debate. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
It's rare one uses the words gossip or gossipy in conjunction with economics, except maybe around Nobel Prize time, which, as it happens, we are. The winner of the Nobel in Economics is going to be announced on Monday, and one of the people perennially on the shortlist for that award is Paul Romer, professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at New York University. If he wins, he will be the toast of the economic town, but there is a bit of a hubbub in the dismal science lately over a paper that Professor Romer wrote that is probably not going to win him any economics prizes. It is called, titled, rather, The Trouble with Macroeconomics. Professor Romer, thanks so much for coming on the program.
It's great to be here.
Start me with a definition, if you would, of what macroeconomics is, just so everybody knows.
In practice, this is the part of economics that worries about recessions and inflation. There's a separate part that worries about the long-run trends in growth, but the recent work I've been writing about has to do with recessions.
Okay. So when this paper, which we will say has been out there for a while now, when it hit my Twitter feed like a week or so ago, whatever it was, the basic through line was, Paul Romer says macroeconomics is garbage. That's not really what you meant.
Well,
Was it?
Well, it's pretty close. I've said that macroeconomics, which was behaving like a science, has become a pseudoscience, something like homeopathy or, you know, the anti-vaxxers in medicine. So it's a very harsh charge.
So what are we supposed to do with this? I mean, you're a leading authority, a voice in the field. You are the brand new chief economist at the World Bank, although you are writing here and speaking here in a personal capacity. What are we supposed to do with this?
You know, the way science works is that everybody is free to say what they think. Others listen. If they're persuaded, then you go in that direction. If they're not persuaded, they go in another direction. Where macroeconomics got in trouble was they started stifling dissent.
Well, so give me a for instance and do it so that I and the rest of us can understand it. Because the first like 20 pages of this paper is all heavy, dense, you know, economic theory stuff with lots of numbers.
Sure. Lots of in-jokes.
Yeah, that's right.
Here's the real sign of the disconnect. In the market, everybody is very focused on whether or not the Fed is going to raise interest rates. And they think that's a big deal. It's going to have a lot of implications. In macroeconomic theory, there is this argument that what the Fed does has no effect on unemployment, no effect on investment, no effect on the rate of GDP growth. It's just it's really an absurd statement, but it's kind of almost like angels on the head of the pin. I don't believe monetary policy matters, and you can't make me.
We are going to get, my guess would be, lots of angry tweets and emails from economists who say, this Romer guy is an idiot. How dare he? So here's your chance.
Yeah, but look, the point is this is the way science works. If I think a bunch of people are saying things that are really absurd, and especially if I think they're ignoring the facts, I'm going to say so.
To which a lot of other economists and analysts and business journalists will pay a lot of attention, but make this matter to my mom or the guy in Ottumwa, Iowa, paying his mortgage or people going about their daily lives.
What happens at the Fed, what Janet Yellen and the other people decide there, or what happens in central banks in other parts of the world is very important. This can make the difference between a high unemployment rate, a slow recovery, or a more rapid recovery. So it's important that the people making those decisions do it based on the best evidence and the best reasoning. And what we're getting from the universities right now is not reliable. It's worse than noise. I think it's just totally off base.
Paul Romer's paper is called The Trouble with Macroeconomics. He wrote it while he was at the Stern School of Business at New York University. He is the brand new chief economist at the World Bank. Professor Romer, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a whole nother kind of foreign exchange market. Forget the British pound that Catherine and Cardiff and I were talking about earlier. Try the tokens from Chuck E. Cheese. Bloomberg reports the company is moving away from actual tokens the kids use to make the games work to rewards cards that can be loaded and reloaded. This is causing no small upset among collectors because it turns out there actually is a market in Chuck E. Cheese tokens. The rarest of them, I'm told, can go for $1,000. Have you been to Chuck E. Cheese? The Dow off 28 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ down 14 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500, 7 points lower, 0.33%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. Thanks today to the staff at Michigan Radio. They are super nice every single time we come here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday back in L.A., everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.